Hello and welcome to the Celestine Show. I'm your host, Dr. Celestine, and I so appreciate your joining us here today. Please don't forget to like, share, and subscribe to our channels on YouTube and bbsradio.com. I am so thrilled to have you join us. We have an extraordinary episode lined up with a topic that resonates deeply with our commitment to education and community. Walking across America in support of HBCUs, or historically Black colleges and universities. As we prepare to interview my next guest, make sure to again like, share, and subscribe to our YouTube channel under The Celeste Stein Show, and be sure to tune in on bbsradio.com to stay updated on all of our episodes. Our special guest for today's show is none other than George Sedbury, also known as GW, and fondly known as GW, an inspiring HBCU advocate whose transformative journey has led him to walk across the United States to raise awareness and foster dialogue about historically Black colleges and universities. GW Sedbury's story is one of resilience and redemption. Once entangled in a life marked by racism, substance abuse, and crime, he has turned his life around in a remarkable way, dedicating himself to highlighting the importance and contributions of HBCUs. Throughout this hour, we will delve into GW's incredible journey, exploring the pivotal moments and all of his life story that actually brought him to this moment where he has redirected his life path, and we will discuss the rich tapestry of Black American history that he aims to bring to a wider audience. GW's mission is not just to walk across America, but to stand in solidarity with HBCUs, emphasizing their crucial role in shaping the future of Black excellence. Get ready for an hour of inspiration, education, and empowerment. This is the Celeste Stein Radio Show, where we bring you stories that matter. GW, welcome to the show.
Thank you. That might have been the greatest opening I've ever had. Thank you.
Well, I don't know about that, but we will certainly hang with you on this journey and see about checking that out. I wanted to begin and first by saying thank you for joining us today to share your story. I wanted to ask you if you could share a little bit about your early life and the challenges that you faced growing up.
I grew up in a small town in Arkansas. I never had air conditioning first through 12th grade. It was hot. I grew up with a truck driver and Vietnam veteran father who was in the Navy and a stay-at-home mother, older sister, younger sister. You know what? I guess would be typical. And we were lower middle class, but I went to a good school. Like I had that normal, those normal things. But I was also brought up in a time and an environment when racism was prevalent, because I know that's what everybody wants to get to. And I grew up in a world where I didn't know any different. I was taught to think things by people I loved and trusted as they were taught the same. And I live in this world where ignorance is bliss, where I lived in a very white community outside of Little Rock and went to college, had my own businesses, and just kind of floated through life, to be honest with you, probably seeking material things and not purpose. So I had a really bad infection in 2001, and they gave me 600 hydrocodone, and I took them religiously because it was bad. I have a huge scar, and I had to wear a pump for 3 months on my arm. But I took them, and no one told me what happened when I would stop taking them, and that became a 10-year downward spiral with an opiate addiction that led me 3 years in prison. I stole jewelry to feed my addiction. I did the crime, I did the time.
Wow, that is quite a story, and I've had to be on that myself after dental surgery about 2 weeks ago. So, thanks for the warning. Who knew? I mean, that something like that could lead in that direction. So, what were some of the key moments as you think back that actually led you down the path of substance abuse and crime? What kind of, I mean, where was the turning point on that part?
Well, I took the hydrocodone and I got really sick afterwards. This was 2001, and pills were easily available back then. And one of the things I noticed about taking the opiates, beside the pain management, I got past that part, was I didn't have to be accountable. I didn't have to be inside my own head. And I, looking back, I realized opiates became a coping mechanism for me. It is for most people. Alcoholism, all of it's a coping mechanism. Long story short, I didn't want to detox because it was so brutal, and I liked the way that my head stayed fuzzy, and I could afford my habit up until about 2010, and then I just got too big for my britches and decided to cross a moral line. I decided to put my morality on a shelf, and I was the attitude I would do anything to feed my addiction.
So what turned it all around? Was there a person or somebody that, or a situation that just kind of hit you and made you say, "Hey, enough of this." What was it?
People often ask if I've dated a Black American woman before. I have not. I've dated women with multi-race or biracial children. And I dated a woman for 4 years who had two daughters, and I grew close to one of those daughters and her grandkids. And that wasn't really anything to do with skin color. It was just I began to see culture, a different culture, with hairstyles and just. And I think that was like tiptoeing in. And then when I went to prison, I had a cellmate named Larry for just about 2 weeks. And Larry one day asked me in the beginning, he goes, "Hey, are you a racist, racist dude?" I'm like, "Yeah, a little bit, kind of." He goes, "Can I ask you some questions?" I'm like, "Sure." So we sat and we talked for 2 weeks. He asked me every kind of question in the world somebody would want to ask somebody who would openly admit to being racist. But I asked him what it was like to be a Black man in Little Rock in America. And that's where I got the value in the conversation, because he and I connected despite growing up 20 minutes apart. He might as well have grown up on Venus, even though we grew up at Venus. I had my money had not hit my books yet for commissary. And when he was moving out, going home, he actually left me food there. And I'm like, "How do I pay you back?" He's like, "Just pay it back, pay it forward to somebody else who has nothing." And just his generosity and kindness and those conversations have never left me. And to this day, I can't remember his last name, because I would look him up and let him, it began with a W, I know that. I would look him up and tell him. But it wasn't just that, it was other conversations with men that began to open my perspective. That's where I think the change, looking back, it started to come.
And you mentioned the young lady that I guess had the interracial children or the biracial children. Tell me about that relationship. What did you learn from that?
Well, for one, I got to date somebody who typically dated black guys. She didn't date a lot of white guys. And I got to understand from her perspective what it was like, the hate she caught from white people. Her family got over it, basically. They love those kids. I met her family. We were together for several years, but I got to hear about her experience. Because that's something I looked down on for so long, was interracial dating. To now date somebody who normally sought out interracial relationships was very different. And at first I didn't know what to think about it, but I adored her kids. At the time, like in the beginning, everybody's rosy and perfect. I didn't realize God had, I think, put that relationship in my life for a reason. It began to open my mind up. On a tangent, though, a lot of my racism came from my father, my mother mainly, but my father also. I didn't know it that during the course of my life, my father completely changed his stance on racism. But I was so blinded that I couldn't see it. It wasn't until after his death that I have friends of mine who happened to be Black tell me my dad was one of the least racist men they knew. And I'm like, "My dad?"
You're like, ah.
But I couldn't see it because I was still mired in my own mental cancer of racism. But I say all that to say, her daughter was in junior high up until we broke up. And my dad, in the last year of his life, he'd gone through brain cancer for the third time. So every Monday night, he would come over. We'd fix him dinner and a big thing of cookies to last him all week. It just became, but he would get there and he would hang out with her daughter on the couch. They'd watch Big Bang Theory, right? We're like, this is a 60-something-year-old white Vietnam grizzled veteran and a 13-year-old Black American girl. And those two just chopped it up. And my dad kept showing up earlier and earlier to spend time with her. We finally say, "Let her get home from school and decompress before you come over, Dad." I think that became the highlight of his week that last year of his life. And I got to see that. And looking back, I aspired to be that.
Children will change you, I tell you that. They make you see some things clearly, a little bit more clearly in terms of what's really important in this life, I think, and what matters. In addition to that, would you say that you actually had some steps that you took, that kind of also change you as a person?
I have a very strong belief in God. And I think I'm confident one of the things I never realized until prison is that I could not be a Christian. I could not love and serve God and be racist at the same time. My morality and my faith in God and my racist ideology had never intersected into that point. That's four
Wow.
decades of my life.
Yeah. And
And I.
but they still say, that's the most segregated hour in America, on Sunday, church time. So I think we all have some questioning of ourselves to do. It's not just you, it's a lot of people that, maybe you don't even think about it because that's how you grew up and it just becomes a part of your life, but that doesn't make it what it should be or make it right. So it's good to the person who actually can realize, hey, is this the best for me or God's best for me, really, in terms of how we live our lives. I also wanted to ask you about the whole HBCU journey, which is historically Black colleges and universities. And I have to point that out because I've met some highly studied people that did not know what HBCUs were. So I have had to explain. And so I want to be open about that. But how did you become interested in that? And again, by the way, I love
Thank you. I was
the
going to wear a Tennessee State for your husband today, but it was actually given to be
shirt.
washed. And I thought, okay, I'll wear Morehouse because Dr. Thomas resigned yesterday.
Yes. Wow.
I grew up around four of them in Little Rock, Celeste. I grew up around Shorter College, Philander Smith, Arkansas Baptist, University of Arkansas, Pine Bluff. And we always just knew them as the Black colleges, right? Even though they're fully integrated. Last year, I do a lot of Black American history research and stories, but HBCUs were a common thread that I kept popping up and popping up. I'm like, okay, I need to dive into this. So I spent about 2 months researching them. I did a video when it went viral, and I looked at my girl that I was dating at the time. I said, "Do you want to go see some campuses?" And we went to Wilberforce and Central State first, and I studied up on them before I went. But when I stood foot on campus, I felt the energy. Like I connected with the history that I had studied, and I'm now standing there. And my dad
Wow.
went to high school with Elizabeth Eckford, one of the Little Rock Nine, and she graduated from Central State. So I'm sitting over there with somebody my dad and uncle went to the same high school with at the same time, her alma mater. You know what I mean? Like there's this weird cosmic connection I felt. And it's off to the races after that.
It's like history in the making, as I guess I don't say a lot, but I went to an HBCU, Spelman College, which is Morehouse's sister school. And so we consider our Morehouse guys Morehouse brothers. And I just remember, hitting the campus, and there just were so many, I guess, children of prominent people. And one of those people happened to be the son of Martin Luther King, who was in school with me, and his daughter, both of them. She was at Spelman, he was at Morehouse. And so, I actually had a roommate whose best friend was actually dating Dexter King. And he would be in my dorm room. And I tell you what, it would be quite the experience. A lot of people will tell you that's the only time they've probably seen me completely speechless. Because, he's the one that looked just like his dad. And I'm just like, you grow up and reading about such a great man in the history books and to actually, meet and see his offspring. And then his sister, Miss Ferris, was one of my teachers when I first got to Spelman. But there were just so many people from, the children of people like Maynard Jackson and Julian Bond's daughter was in my class, and Bill Cosby's daughter was like, I guess, a freshman when I was a senior. But you're like, but it's such a good environment to foster support, but you also realize you You really can't compare yourself to anyone else. You have to really get in there and learn your stuff and really get to know everything there is out there before you hit the world, if you will. So when you started doing the HBCU tours and this walk across America, how did that come about? Tell me about the idea to actually, trek. Were you watching Forrest Gump or something?
Well, the HBCU tour kicked off last Memorial Day weekend when I asked you to go see some schools, and I realized I wanted to see all 101 of them. Okay, so that's become a lifelong goal, a bucket list item, and I'm 31 into that, by the way. So I am a third of the way through my goal. But
Yay, congratulations.
I was Lincoln University this morning. I'll tell you what happened there today. When I was in prison, I was in isolation for 28 days. And the window I could see out looked at a wall. And when I looked out the door, it looked at another door. And I'm at the end of the tier. So it's probably 300 men in there. And I could only hear shouting echoes. I can't. So I'm sealed off. I can't see anything. And I only got let out for 2 3-minute showers a week. Otherwise, I never left this frigid, freezing cold box. And the light never went off because somebody was on a live watch. No Bible, no nothing. I was losing my grip on reality. So I would lay there and force myself to focus, think about walking from where I was back to where I grew up. And then as I did that, I would imagine the road, the trees, and then I would start seeing people and I would have just imaginary. And this became a coping mechanism while I was incarcerated. Then I got out, didn't think about it. And then one day I saw a documentary about a gentleman named Gabriel Cadeiros who wheelchaired across America because he's paralyzed from the
Saw
waist
that.
just down. And I was so moved by it. The next day, I met a pair of twin brothers in Fort Wayne, Indiana, who were walking from LA to New York. And I'm like, okay, God, you got my attention. That's like 12 hours apart. But I didn't know my why. I'd been looking for my why until this past winter. And then I realized I wanted to create conversation about HBCUs because there's a huge part of the country that doesn't know anything about them. There are black children in this country who don't know anything about them. So if I could get out and start walking and talking and sharing these amazing stories of Black American history, because Black history is American history, and I can't say that enough. And the scenery changes, and the people I meet create stories. I just thought that that's what God wanted me to do. So.
Well, some people might look at HBCUs and say, why, and maybe even think that they're bad. What do you say to those people?
Well, for one, I'll start going down like you wouldn't have 3D. You wouldn't be able to send 3D images without a Morgan State graduate named Dr. Valerie Thomas, who worked for NASA. You wouldn't have accurate GPS without Dr. Gladys West of Virginia State. I can go down, you wouldn't have the incandescent part of the light bulb, that Otis Boyk of Fisk University. They've changed. Graduates have changed our world. We have right now, Dr. Day Nicole Green is a professor at Morehouse School of Medicine. She's using lasers to destroy cancer cells.
Yeah, very able to pinpoint. Yeah, I mean, amazing stuff.
This
Yeah.
is and
Charles Drew, I went to school with and actually grew up with his grandson,
really.
Ernie Jarvis, yes. And just that what an amazing story that he died because the blood plasma that he created and discovered, he couldn't have access to that.
No, I want to correct one myth right here. Dr. Charles Drew died in a wreck. He was driving and his pinned with foot was severely pinned under the accelerator in the wreck. And it cut so bad, he bled out. He had up three other doctors from Tuskegee with him. And in their witness statements, they said if they would have removed him, he would have died faster. The way it was pinned slowed his bleeding down, but nobody could have gotten to him to save his life. He was with three physicians when he passed away. So
Well,
I would dispel that myth that I
but
look.
they always put in the history books that it was because he couldn't get a blood transfusion.
He
So
never made it
that,
to the hospital. He bled out on scene. I looked
interesting.
and found that I found the witness statements. I went to the Library of Congress.
That's amazing. Wow. I think the majority of people I know the other story. So, wow. And so that's another reason it's so important. A lot of things have come to a screeching halt due to COVID-19, but you should know that the court system in Tennessee is still open and holding in-person hearings for orders of protection and other types of abuse cases. If you have a hearing date, double-check on where your hearing will be held. If you need assistance on an order of protection or temporary restraining order, contact the Legal Aid Society at 1-800-238-1443 or visit our website at www.las.org.
We unfortunately had a power outage and we are still without power and without internet for some odd reason. Everything went out. That is a first in the history of the show. So I guess this is a historical show in many different ways. We're here today again with George Sedbury, and we are talking about his tour across America with HBCUs. An amazing story. And George, I'm just so delighted that you have joined us today and want to continue our conversation about HBCU. So we were talking a little bit about Charles Drew, and thank you for sharing that amazing story as to what happened with him and the information that you learned. I wanted to ask you, was there anything that really particularly changed your life in terms of how and why you wanted to become an advocate for historically Black colleges and universities?
You know, it's when I got on my knees, I was praying, and I finally stopped asking God to help me. And I said, how can I serve others? And I meant it for the first time in my life. And in that week, my life changed. I launched a video about making fun of racists, actually, and it went mega viral. And they say one video can change your life in the right. And it doesn't happen overnight, but it happens. And I realized in that moment what I felt in my heart and mind. I found a platform and a voice and a way to put it out there. It just everything came together for me. And I knew at that moment, I knew I didn't want to stay silent, but I didn't know how to speak up. And there's a difference. And once I found the avenue to start speaking and speaking up, I just knew everything clicked and fell into place for me. Mm-hmm. Like you hear about it, but it took me 52 years to just know.
Yeah. Oh, well, along your journey, have you had some, tell us about any memorable moments that you've had along the way as you've trekked and gone through a third of your journey thus far. What are some of the most memorable moments that you've had?
You know, I've met, you know, like Jasmine Guy from A Different World. When I came off stage and speaking on Apollo, she came up behind me and put her hands on my shoulders and she's like, "You're amazing." And I turned and look, I'm like, "Oh my God, it's Whitley." You know, everybody, I had a crush on her. You know, I met her, I met, you know, Dwayne Wayne, I met AJ Calloway, I met, like, you know, Robert Smith, the billionaire, like just random, all these different people. But I think it's the students at the schools, because yesterday I talked to a Morehouse student that I met last summer. And every once in a while, he just calls me and checks on me. He's a sophomore, another sophomore. And I was in Michigan a month ago. I went and saw a Morehouse student because his dad and I are friends. I went and had dinner with him just to make sure he's okay while his internship. Like these young men that I've met and some women, the friendships. You know, the fact that some of them will call me with racial questions, you know, and from their perspective as a 19 or 20 year old in Atlanta, and they're asking what I think about things. Man, who else does that happen to? You know?
Yeah. Amazing.
I had dinner with Freddie Mitchell, the Philadelphia Eagles. You know, went to UCLA in Philadelphia. I spent an afternoon with JT Thomas, who won 4 Super Bowls with my beloved Pittsburgh Steelers. You know, he was the first Black American football player at Florida State and a first round pick of the Steelers in the 70s. That's a big deal. And I'm sitting there, we're just chopping it up for hours. Like I spent Valentine's Day with Miss Althea Thompson, Miss Alabama State, 1953, and Dr. Martin Luther King's organist at the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. I spent Valentine's Day with her. She's 90 and 6:30. You know, I told her, "Don't crack," and she's like, "It sure don't, honey." And she looked amazing. But where else would I get to do, you know, one of the youngest freedom risers, Hezekiah Stewart? I spent time with him in Jackson. You know, he was arrested 109 times. They put him on death row in Parchman Prison in Mississippi. Joan Trump Hour Mulholland, the white lady that the Delta that was a civil rights icon, a freedom rider, you know, in Jackson, Texas. She's the first white student to go to Tougaloo. I've got to go to her house and meet with her. Like,
Wow. Yeah.
my
Yeah. Isn't that something? I mean, I guess it's just a real blessing, it sounds like, that you've been able to really do some really memorable things. But one of the things I wanted to ask also is, how do you think, as you're speaking, do you ever talk about how HBCUs are able to really contribute to and work to promote Black American history and culture? Is that something that you talk about as you're, engaging with the different schools across the country?
I stay in my lane when it comes to my observations and opinions. I hear a lot of things. I know Tennessee State, I believe they were looking for an African American studies professor. Several people that I know in administration told me that. And I'm thinking, this is a very renowned HBCU and they're having trouble. I'm looking at certain school districts pulling this stuff out, not teaching it, and that scares the crap out of me. It feels a little bit like Germany maybe back in the day when you do that. So, I think it's hard to have an opinion because I try to educate people in a different way than like a typical college classroom would. But I guess the thing I struggle with, as many cool stories as I tell, no school can possibly teach all the great stories. I don't know how you pick and choose what you can teach when there's so many beautiful things to be able to teach. You know what I mean? Like, so. It's hard for me to answer, especially being a white guy and not growing up in the culture and community.
Yeah, it can be a little challenging from that point of view. So I did want to ask also, as you engage with the students and the alumni, what is it, that you are really trying to, I guess, convey? Or is it more just kind of listening? Tell me about that part of it.
Think, being in introspective about it, I think I go through these experiences to absorb as much energy and knowledge and information and love as I can, because I feel like I'm good at regurgitating it out, coming back out with a story of my experiences. But I say this, and I think it needs to be on my tombstone: Black America healed my racist heart.
Wow, that's the, I mean, I'm gonna remember that. That is very profound. It's only lived experiences, I think, that actually can teach us where we learn the truth. And I think a lot of times with whatever we're getting at in life, we're really trying to get to that. What is truth? What is really true and honorable? And so many people go through life just day to day, believing whatever they hear, not really engaging in, studies to learn what is true. And so, what a remarkable task that you have engaged in that. I want to take a quick break. Hopefully, we can get through this hour without any more power outages and that kind of thing. But I want to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about the other two thirds of the journey and some of the things that you're going to want to accomplish there. So we'll be back right after this.
When it comes to relationships, there are some obvious signs you can use to spot someone who might be abusive. First, they have a tendency to want to rush into a relationship. They may also show signs of jealousy and mistrust, and you could find they expect you to be perfect and will try to cut you off from other important relationships. They could also be abusive towards animals and children. To learn more about the signs of dangerous individuals and how you can identify and avoid unhealthy relationships, contact the Legal Aid Society at 1-800-238-1443.
And welcome back. We're here with George Sedbury, and he is talking about his trek across America. to visit with HBCUs across the country. And George, again, thank you for joining us. I wanted to ask you, you said you've managed to get through a third of your journey. I wanted to ask, how are you able to manage the physical and mental demands of such a long and challenging journey across the country?
You know, I need to put it out there, but I deal with a lot of depression. I thought that the exercise and the fresh air would help with that. And the loneliness, because I'm alone 99.9% of the time, it weighs on me a lot. A lot more than I thought it would. I thought prison prepared me. It didn't. My knees, I can push myself really hard. My feet will give out before my knees do. But once I stop moving, I'm so stiff. Like, it is a chore to get out of bed every day because I am brutalizing my body. And to break down my day, because I can't walk linear because I'm not camping or sleeping on the ground. I'm too old and fat for that. But, you know, like in Philadelphia, I walked a 15-mile loop around back to my pickup truck, right? So that's how I did. Or I may walk, 7.5 miles forward and backtrack 7 so I can advance 15. So I'm putting in the mileage, and I have a 20-mile-a-day goal. So when I can't walk, I'll get on my bicycle and ride those few miles to keep my 20 miles up, the integrity. But it's easier and harder than I thought. How about that? I'm going to need new knees when this is over. I have arthritic knees and they ache. They ache every minute of every day. But at the same time, I mean, what's that pain compared to what I'm trying to accomplish? You know, I mean, I sleep in my truck, or I have people that have actually gifted me hotel points, or I'm trying to manage my money enough. When it's hot or rainy, I will get a room, and it helps. But I don't know. I just feel like what I'm doing right now is preparing me for the next chapter of my life. Like, I need to go through this. I need to feel this. I need to experience, meet these people. I need to absorb all this, because my next step is going to be something more significant, and it's just, I feel like I've got to do it.
Mm-hmm. So have you had any incidents where maybe you weren't well received, or has it always been just a very positive experience?
I don't really have any negative. I'm kind of a force of a personality anyway. I know how to tell jokes.
Nah, I would have never guessed that. No.
To be honest with you, it's white people. When I tell them what I'm doing, they'll be like, really? Like, I've had more white people hear me talking to somebody at a restaurant and come buy my dinner. But then I'll say, ask me why I'm doing it. And then I'll tell them, about HBCUs and Black American history, and their faces are like, wow. Like, I have not had a negative experience in that regard at all. Because I think that what I'm doing is so out of normal realm for people that it's hard to grasp. So it's a great conversation starter. But yeah. No, I really haven't.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask, you come from a fairly tumultuous background. What do you have to say to those people who may have had sort of a similar upbringing? Now that you've had some of the experiences that you've had, what do you have to say to some of those people who may be struggling with similar things, like, racism or what have you? I don't know if you've ever had the opportunity to really have that conversation, but what do you say to them?
To that, I probably had 40 or 50 men and women reach out to me, white people, to ask me about confronting their own racism. They know they want to beat it, but they have no idea how to start. So I've had those conversations. To somebody that grew up with a really traumatic childhood, I had to accept that I have PTSD from it, that I am who I am because of it. And I've made bad choices and good. I know that if I could tell my 20-year-old self now, 30 years of wisdom, is that it's all going to make sense. It all will come together. Everything you've been through has a purpose. There's a skill. There is a character trait. There is something you're going to develop from everything you've been through. I don't know when it's going to be. You just got to keep working. But when that moment hits, you'll look back and go, now I get it. And now that you can weaponize that past instead of letting it hold you back, it can become a tool. And that's the way I feel about mine.
Yeah. A minute ago, you mentioned that you have faced some physical limitations and struggles. How do you find yourself able to bounce back? the next day?
I've had a life of pain, a lot of physical pain. I've had meningitis. I've had a lot of things happen. I don't know. I guess I can just, what's the word I'm looking for? I can break it down and separate physical pain, mental pain. Like sometimes I think it's addictive that I can push and push and push and take it. At the moment, it's afterwards that it hurts and it catches up. But in the moment, I don't know. I just have that ability to just take pain. Paper cuts, no, I'll cry like a little girl over a paper cut. Don't get me wrong. But just constant throbbing and pounding, yeah, I can just take it. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think it's important, the resilience and being able to, live and walk and strive another day, because life is been very tough for a lot of people, certainly after COVID, and we don't need one more thing really to have to worry about. But so how much does politics come into play when you're traveling and speaking? Does that ever come up into the conversation?
People bring it up, but like I'd like to tell people, I'm a convicted felon and while I'm still on parole for one more week. I have to apply to have that restored. But I listen to people. I don't offer a lot of opinions on political things. If I do, I'm very neutral because I want to see where people stand. Politically, I'm very right in the middle. I think there's good and bad all the way around, and I tend to look for the good and discard the bad. That's the way I think. I also realize I don't know what I don't know. And I hear some people give very strong opinions, and I respect their opinion. It's their world. But I hear it from both sides. I hear extreme left, extreme right arguments. And it's funny because the people on the far right tend to tiptoe around me. Do you know what I mean? I hear some stupid stuff. I'm going to correct them. Like, that's just wrong. But they tend to tiptoe, believe it or not. I don't, I think we're, No, let me back up. I have an 84-year-old uncle, and when Trump first came around, he's a lifelong Democrat, and I definitely skewed more conservative at the time. And I asked him, "The world is speeding up." He's like, "No, it's not. You're just more aware of it because of social media." He goes, "I lived through the end of World War II, the Red Scare." He goes, "I lived through Korea, Vietnam. You know, the set. Just I, he goes, "I've lived through it all already. This is no different. It's just you're more aware." You know, he told me why Trump wouldn't be successful. He goes, because Trump's a businessman in a bureaucracy, and he's going to try to turn a battleship around in a bathtub, and it can't be done. That was the analogy he used.
Wow.
He
That's
also
sort of pretty interesting.
wrote the budget for the state of Arkansas for 40 years. He has been in political and that in state administration his whole career, so he saw things differently. You know, he knew Bill and Hillary, worked with him. Loved Bill, hated Hillary. Just to tell you right now, or disliked Hillary, working with her. But yeah, and my dad grew up very Republican, and my uncle's very Democrat, which is kind of my grandparents were Democrat. So, I grew up hearing these things, the back and forth. So I understood conversations need to be held on both sides.
Yeah, it's important. I remember growing up, my dad used to always say, "Stay away from politics, like wherever you go, the workforce, whatever, just stay away." 'Cause it just, I think that kind of taught me to listen more. Because it's hard to resolve any issue if you always have your mouth open, trying to refute a point. That means you're really not listening. So you kind of have to listen to be able to really solve issues in a way where you're getting to the best possible solution, not just making a solution that, one person may think is right, because, well, they always say two heads are better than one, right? So it really does help, I think, to have community and to listen to others and really gather and compile a lot of information so that you are able to kind of decipher things and really be able to make proper decisions. So tell me about your journey. So where did you start as you were starting your walk? Where did you start and where do you plan to end up? And is there some significance to how you start and how you end up?
I started in Harlem, New York on 125th Street on April 28th because I spoke on stage at the Apollo last September. And I just thought that night changed my life. So I thought that would be the place I'd start. And I'm traversing the country and I'll end up hopefully the 1st of November in Los Angeles at the Dr. Charles Drew School of Medicine in South Central Los Angeles. And if Houston Tillotson has their new campus open or possibly up and running, I spoke to their president. I want to go by there. That's my destination, but really it's everywhere in between. I'm in Jefferson City right now, which is home of Lincoln University, founded in 1866, one of only two HBCUs in Missouri. But from here, I'm going to go start heading down towards Tulsa. And I'm going to deviate down to Little Rock to get my freedom papers from the parole office and see friends and some family. But Tulsa, Oklahoma City, and then after that, I'm just headed out west. I am going to be crossing through Texas, Nevada, Arizona, into California. So it's going to be a lot of nothing once I leave Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be the biggest struggle of this whole journey is going to be that part of it.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the questions I had, too, was, you know, have people joined with you in this, or is it just you alone walking across America? Have you had any support or people, you know, how in Forrest Gump he started running, next thing he knows he has all these people running behind him? I was just curious about that.
I had somebody start with like the first 7 or 8 miles with me in New York. He walked all the way out of Manhattan with me to New Jersey. And outside of that, no. I've asked people, said I'll be at this place or that, and my follower base is so broad. Like if I said I was in Pittsburgh and I'm gonna be here at the stadium, a few people said, hey, I might, and then it didn't, so I kind of gave up. But I'm about to start going forward. I'm trying to shake my platform up. I'm going to start doing a BOBWWG, Black-Owned Businesses with White George. And I'm going to announce ahead of time when I'll be in town because I have a guy I want them to get a hold of. And I'm not charging a business for this. I want to go lift up small businesses in the Black community because it costs me nothing. And if I've got to eat somewhere, I'd rather eat. And I want to interview and just create that positivity. You know what I mean? And connect with people. Yeah. But I think letting people know where I'll be when business is reaching out so I can do that, I think that'll help to shift things.
Mm-hmm. And as I know, you're going to be doing more public speaking. When you do your keynote addresses, what do you think are going to be some of your key focal points?
Two things. It's about redemption, that people can change, and that Black history is American history. And those two things go together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting you bring that up, because a lot of times it is very much separated, and you know, you have months, you know, Black History Month, and I like the idea or the notion of, hey, it is part of history in general. I mean, it's all part of the same pot as far as all of the things that have transpired. You know, it transpired with everybody. So
we here as a country, we would not be a superpower if we didn't have Black America within us. It would have never happened. Economically, we could never be where we are. Mm-hmm. And I think when I realized that, it changed. When I realized, or I saw that the world wasn't like I thought it was, we didn't do everything, we didn't make everything, that we were a big integrated team doing it, whether we want to agree with it or not. And I just want to show people that. And so speaking, right, I want to find creative ways to open people's minds to that.
Yeah, I think that's so important. Sometimes people feel limited. Sometimes it's they're in a mental prison in their own mind where they just think they can't do something, because you can have a physical prison, like you mentioned, but you can also have limitations in your own head. And so you have to find ways to free your mind, you know, if you will, and be able to get beyond that. Now, if people want to join you, you said you didn't have a lot of people, but if there are people who are interested in getting behind you with what you're working on, I know you're doing a tremendous job on social media. It seems like you have quite the following. But, you know, what are some ways people can support you?
Well, I have a GoFundMe. I have the link in both my Instagram and TikTok profiles, and I have Cash App. That's primarily the ways I've had people that sent me points to Hilton hotels. That's usually the easiest ways people can, but they can also just like, comment, and repost my videos. That helps me tremendously too. And So far I'm actually about to launch merchandise. I'm kind of playing with what because it's something I represent that has to do with Black history's American history. And that's probably the key way. Unless somebody has an RV they're not using and would like the tax write-off letting me use it, yeah, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, that sounds like that would be awesome. I'm glad to hear that people are really getting in there and supporting you, because it's such a worthwhile mission. And thank you for your service in doing that, because a lot of people don't know about HBCUs and the rich, rich history of HBCUs. And people don't often realize or recognize the fact that when these schools were created, it was because there was no place else people could go. And, I think a lot of people overlook that fact. It's not like people were really trying to be separate or anything like that. It's just there were no other options. And so that people did get in there and get an education, so important, because as a nation, I think, overall, we wouldn't be where we are if we didn't have our teachers, our educators that help people to be better, to learn, to do better. So wonderful, wonderful opportunity that you have there, and we appreciate what you're doing wholeheartedly. I want to say that we're just about out of time. Is there anything else you'd like to share before we wrap up today?
I somehow think that even though I'm homeless walking across the country, I think HBCUs and this journey has enriched my life unlike anything ever before. Like I've met you and your husband Everett, and I have met just countless numbers of people that I will carry with me the rest of my life. Like when I tell you my cup runneth over, and all I had to do is get my big butt out there and start moving and talking to people, and just the more love you show, the more love you're given in return. Like it's an infinite loop once you crack into it. And like you said,
Right.
people in mental prisons, they hold the key. They always hold the key to their own cell. That's the crazy part. The more
Yeah.
love and kindness you put out, the more that you're given in return. That's the secret to life.
And also how courageous, but to actually step out on faith. And do what you heard to do, that you dreamt about, that you saw. And that's half the people don't do that, but that's how you actually see and complete your life's mission and purpose, by stepping out on faith like that. So I commend you there as well, because people have no idea sometimes, how, I guess, just doing what you have in your spirit, sometimes that's where you're supposed to go. So hats off to you on that. Well, we are about out of time. Thank you so much, George Sedbury, for being here today. If you would like more information about George, you can feel free to visit us at www.bsaprinc.com, and we can certainly put you in touch with George. It has certainly been an honor to share this hour with you, and your inspiring journey. If you missed any part of today's show, due to power outages or whatever else, or you would like to hear more or any of our other shows, please be sure to visit our YouTube channel and also bbsradio.com, where you can catch this and other episodes of the Celestine Show. And again, big thank you to you, George, or GW, shall we say, Sedbury, for sharing your mission with us. I will say until next time, this is Dr. Celeste Stein, and I appreciate your joining us today. Please remember to stay inspired and keep making a difference. Thank you.
Thank you.